So the original book came out in 1987. Who was the publisher?
Athenaeum.
Athenaeum.
Right.
Now, you did this with your husband, Alan.
Yes, that's right.
Tell me how the original concept developed for the American Chronicle.
Well, Alan and I had always been very much interested in American culture, and for very different reasons, in a way. We were coming at it from entirely different directions. Since I teach literature, I was always interested to know what was going on in a certain year to place, for example, a Hemingway novel or a Faulkner novel of the 20s, a Fitzgerald novel, into the period, to understand what the jazz age was, why was he the chronicler of the 20s. And there really was no book that had under a single cover what people were painting and popular songs and what in fact was happening. So that was really my interest. It was really rather academic. Alan's, on the other hand, grew out in doing the book, grew out of his practice in that he observed that, I guess it's very commonsensical, that people who had grown up in different periods were going to have completely different psychologies, and that concrete personal memory really was very much associated with public event. And so someone growing up in the 50s was going to have an entirely different upbringing and sense of American materialism and conformism and perhaps the McCarthy threat and so forth than someone who was growing up in the 60s when life was somewhat more permissive and so forth. And so I guess there was really even another reason, in that we had always, as I suspect many people do, at the end of every year, felt a certain way about a year. It was a good year. It was a bad year. It was that each year had a kind of personality. And although I might be able to talk about the year, for example, that my son was born, since that was such a wonderful year for me, or the year I graduated from college, in a way, all the years started melting together, and we thought that maybe we could, and we hope we did, write a book where people could read it and get information that would bring the years alive to them again and cover not just the years of their youth, but cover, in a way, three generations. This involved, the real challenge of this was that we thought, well, we'll chronicle the news events, and we'll chronicle the books and the art and popular songs and movies and science and technology and so forth. But ultimately, there was no limit to the categories we had to cover, so that we felt that in order to give a correct personality of a year, we had to list the price of eggs and list the styles and list the fads and list the new words and list ads as the ads reflected particular historical happenings or as they were innovative, state certain quotations that have become a part of American history, quotations from, well, the obvious, you know, the Watergate, World War II, and so on and so forth. But there was no end to the categories. Of course, we did organize them. Every year has about 8 or 10 pages devoted to a number of categories that follow year after year. And I hope that we were able to accomplish this kind of recreation of each year and each decade, which then is prefaced by an introduction which tries to give an overview of social and political and economic and cultural happenings. But we hope to be able to write a book so that it could be used both in an academic way for people who wanted to fill in the gaps, but perhaps even more importantly, it could just be a fun book where people could recall certain songs and movies and events and understand their parents' lives and understand their, maybe even their grandparents' lives.
I've used it both ways. It's fun to leaf through and look at those years. But sometimes when I want to know something, you can go to those years. But you selected 1920 as the beginning.
Right.
Why 1920? Right.
We selected 1920 because it seemed to us that in 1920 America became what we would call modern America. There was so much in the way of new technology. There was such an enormous spurt of energy. Radio, as a matter of fact, the first radio broadcast took place from Pittsburgh in 1920. And the global village began through radio. People heard for the first time Harding's inaugural address. They heard the news of Lindbergh's landing. They heard about the unknown soldier, the dedication to the unknown soldier at Arlington Cemetery. They had, through radio, not just an awareness of the news, but they had a common reservoir in addition of entertainment. Amos and Andy was enormously popular. The Ipana Troubadours, there were regularly scheduled classical music concerts and so forth. And because of this, advertising began, real advertising began in the 1920s. And film, movies in the 20s took on sound. The jazz singer was 1927, 1928. And there was a common reservoir of culture heroes that were available to everyone. Probably the most significant thing, I mean, perhaps the main reason we chose that year was because the car and Henry Ford and the availability of more money for less work so that people could more commonly buy what were luxury items. I mean, everybody owned a car. Everybody began to own the new toaster and the new refrigerator, the icebox, as it was called, and the vacuum cleaner, and it was a time women started gaining, and women gained the vote. It was a time when women shed their cumbersome hoops and feathers, and speakeasies opened because prohibition went into effect, and there was a change in the morality of America. It just seemed to us that this really was the beginning of modern America. Needless to say, it was not our intention, I have to be honest, but at the time, it was the beginning also when communism found its first home following World War I, and it certainly World War I was the time at which America aided in ending the war, became a major figure in the world stage, and communism and democracy and capitalism became the two vying political ideologies, which, interestingly enough, in 89, right.
You had to start somewhere.
Right.
So the original edition, which came out in 1987, ended in 1987?
It ended in 1979.
In 1979.
The first edition. This one now has the last decade. It goes from 80...
So now you brought it up from
80 to 89.
So you've added another 10 years.
That's right.
To this.
Uh-huh. Right.
Now, was the original edition an oversized paperback?
It was, yes.
And it was not in
hardcover. And it was hardcover as well.
Both a hardcover.
Yeah.
And the new edition is also in paper?
Is not in paper. It's only hardcover.
I see. Mm-hmm. I was looking in science and technology. I see you do not have the birth of the Macintosh computer. Shame on you.
We do not.
Revolutionary computer.
Is that so that we don't have? We have the Apple.
What year was the
Apple? You know, I don't remember. To be honest, my husband should be here for the memory. He remembers dates.
I don't want to be too specific. This is more conversational.
Yeah.
But that's right. The Apple was the first practical desktop computer for the home.
Right.
So, I mean, that was really a milestone.
Right.
Now, let's look a little bit about how you have... just parenthetically. In a way, it would be nice for you to go back, though. I'd like to see you... Go back to 1775.
Oh, God.
So you really have a chronicle.
I won't live that long. we had thought of starting in 1900, and we collected some photos, but this is obviously an expensive book to produce, so I think that it was felt that we should just begin, rather than with the general, with the photos and with some very broad generalizations, that we should begin in 1920. Another reason, though, to begin in 1920 is that, as I said before, it really covers three generations, and we had hoped that it would allow people to, in a way, recover a kind of family identity and to reach back to... I mean, most of us have some family that lived in 1920 or in the 1920s. It's a long time ago. But reaching back even further than that, I'm not sure it would be quite as appropriate in terms of sharing it with family members and so on.
Now, how you could spend weeks on each individual year. How did you and your husband break down the research?
Alan did certain categories himself entirely, as I did, and then we shared others. He did all of the, we have a demographic profile of each year, and we have a news section. He did those sections. He did the sports sections himself.
I assume you did the culture.
I did the Yes, and I did the music and I did the art. We did the popular culture. I don't really like these words, but as opposed to the paintings and the sculpture and the opera, we did the movies and the songs, and we did the science and technology together. We did actually, I think my favorite section is the kaleidoscope, and we did that together. That is the concluding page of every year where we flesh out some of the major news events. For example, it really would not be adequate only to talk about the fact that in 1968 Martin Luther King was assassinated. So we have, in the quotes, we have statements about the assassination, but in this kaleidoscope section, we say, for example, that it was either in 68 or 69 that Sears and Roebuck stopped advertising guns, and that certain comments were made, or we fill in details. We also have some amusement. We have jokes of the year, and we have the fads in that section.
That's terrific. In 1955 was the year I graduated from high school. I said Debbie Reynolds and Eddie Fisher got married.
Right.
And the major fad was the Davy Crockett hat.
That's right.
And then you have new words,
right.
First appearances.
Right.
Disneyland, for example, made its
right.
First appearance in 1955. But this is only 1955. I mean, anybody who has a special year could go to that year and pick out these things that may be just a distant memory.
Yeah.
That's a wonderful thing. Well,
thank you.
When you did your research, you went to newspapers. How did you do it exactly? Go to newspapers?
Well, there is there's really a mountainous amount of information available.
That's the problem.
A mountainous, that's right.
And
we
weed it all out.
It was an enormous, we could do a book on how we did this book, because it was just, we spent about a year trying to figure out a methodology. Of course, we started with the newspapers, and there have been lots and lots of newspapers. We read newspapers not just from New York, but newspapers from around the country. It's because we were writing not just about major news events, we were writing about prices, and we were writing about styles, and we were writing about sports, and so on and so forth, and we were writing about art shows and musical events, and so on. We read magazines. We read, every industry has its own cluster of journals. I mean, we used, just in terms of getting popular songs, we used Billboard and Downbeat and Cashbox. And they not only each publish monthly, but they publish little monographs periodically and list songs and singers and what the sales are. And so we went through all kinds of industry publications and governmental publications. And then we read many, many books on the different areas that established authorities had written about the evolution of an art form or something of that sort. When we had put it all together, we then consulted a number of specialists in each area to make sure that our lists were not eccentric, because we wanted to include both what was very popular at the time, so that people could understand what movie or what show or what opera was very successful and very important at the time, which today no one may remember. And at the same time, we wanted to include work that at the time was, for example, a book that was published, let's say Faulkner, who really was not read when he was published in the late 20s. He was read by the French first, and then it wasn't until later that the American public started reading Faulkner. So it was really an enormous job trying to balance what was significant at the time with what has become important. So we showed our lists, fearing that they might be eccentric in some ways, to specialists in each of these categories. And, for example, because both of us were weak in ballet, consulted a man who's written three books in ballet, who also has a radio program and who discusses ballet and opera, and he read the list. Our inclusion of ballet is very, very small in each year, but of course we had to include that.
Thank God.
we consulted in terms of movies. We consulted a man who has been a field editor for a major publisher, who has been the editor of many, many books on American film and has written several himself.
I would imagine the hard part would be the developing the slang and the new words and the fads.
I don't know if I should be embarrassed or proud to admit that we started this book in 1982, and it really became a way of life. I mean, we Fortunately, we are still together, but I would not recommend doing a book with a spouse. My husband had an anniversary celebration, an alumni reunion from, he went to Bronx High School of Science in 83, and, several friends called, and we just can't go. I mean, we don't go out. We didn't go out. We did not go out for years. We stayed home. I mean, it was wonderful. We enjoyed it. I mean, we would go out and go to art shows, and we would go out, and every building was important to look at, and, you know, I mean, everything we did was how does it end this book?
You kind of developed an obsession, I guess, for this
project. We did. Yeah. To be honest, we did.
Did you just start it from scratch, or did you have a book contract, or what?
No, we started from scratch.
Yeah, and then say, this is what we want to do, and then you present it?
That's what we did. Yeah. Well, we worked up a few years. But I can't, as I said when we were walking in here before, I can't even begin to tell you how much went into this in terms of the research. And we wanted to write it in a very sort of friendly way, we wanted all of the we have a section on fashion, and we have a section on science. We wanted to make the discussion of fashion of interest to, I hate to be sexist about this, but we wanted them to make the discussion of fashion of interest to every man who read the book as well as every woman, and we wanted them to make the discussion of sports.
Well, men are interested in fashion. They don't know it, however.
Yeah.
But they're aware of it in subtle ways.
And science. We wanted to make the science very, understandable to the ordinary reader, because I don't know a lot of the terminology. So it was a real job getting everything into making everything accurate and precise at the same time.
No, it's beautifully laid out. I mean, you go to a year and nicely organized, categorized.
Thank you, and
very readable. Did you say this was also a combination hardcover and paperback?
No, this is just hardcover.
But it will be in paperback at some point.
I hope. I don't know. I really don't know.
Such a wonderful, not only is it wonderful to read, it's such a terrific research tool. And the new publisher is Crown.
Right.
Well, there was some legal difficulty with the title, wasn't there?
No.
Chronicle Books, what happened there? Wasn't there something?
I don't know.
Or am I mistaking you?
I may have told, we were appalled when we had worked on this for so many years, when we were appalled to discover that as this book was in the works and was due out at any minute, that Chronicle Publishers published a book called Chronicle. It has a similar title. I don't even want to say it because this had been in the works for so many years, and that, I mean, I it's a very different book. That book is a series of it's a much larger book, and it's a series of news items, just news items, one after another, and it juxtaposes events from different aspects of international events, not just American events. But I don't know if there was a problem. I must tell you, I don't know about it.
It probably wasn't your book. There was a legal problem. I read it in Publishers Weekly, and I think it dealt with Chronicle Books and something else that had the name Chronicle in it. And
really?
Yeah, but it obviously wasn't. Yours.
No, I don't. Well,
you'd know about
so.
It.
No, I don't know.
Because it was resolved in court somehow.
Oh no, it must have been another.
As I recall, I really even shouldn't speculate now because I'm very vague, but they had some settlement where they were, one entity was allowed to keep the title with Chronicle in it and the other, I'm sure it dealt with Chronicle Books in San Francisco, but I just can't remember.
Actually, I thought that titles, I didn't think that there was a kind of copyright on titles.
I thought you could
use a title. I mean, I thought you could repeat titles.
Yeah, if you look in the library, you'll see.
Sure.
Books with the same title, which is a little confusing sometimes.
Sure.
If you see it, lots of times.
We were originally going to call this Modern Times, and then Paul Johnson's book came out, so we decided that we wouldn't do that. And American Chronicle seemed to be kind of accurate since it's year by year.
It's a very nice name. Is it your intention every few years you're going to update the book?
If we have the strength. My son is now in college. It was not, I think that the only thing, I make it sound as if we didn't breathe. I mean, we did spend time with him, and now he's off in school. So we would have even that much more time to spend if at the end of the 90s it seems appropriate to update it.
Well, now that American Chronicle has gone to press, what do you do?
I teach American literature and modern literature at Fairleigh Dickinson University in New Jersey. Mm-hmm. Alan is a psychiatrist. And so I have a book on Pinter, Harold Pinter, that's coming out next month. And so I'm always
a literary criticism.
It's a collection of essays. Yes, it's in honor of his 60th birthday. But yep. I write about. I'm also writing a book on Samuel Beckett, and I'm finishing, I hope, another project that's a kind of interdisciplinary study of different arts in the modern, the effects of song. It sounds terribly pretentious, but the effect of science and contemporary philosophy in the techniques of certain modern artists and composers and writers.
I'm trying to understand Beckett. I have a number of Beckett's books that I bought, say were published by New Directions.
Mm-hmm.
And they were on remainder, so I bought a whole stack of them and began trying to read them. And was baffled, and I think I'm going to have to do some re-education before I approach Beckett. You know Beckett, right? You know his stuff.
I know his stuff. Well, he dismisses the traditional elements of plot and plot and characterization.
Does he know what a paragraph is?
Well, he dismisses all of that. I think he's trying to say that it's really very difficult to believe that the world is organized in any way in terms of causation, you know, which would suggest beginning, middle, and end, or in terms of character, or in terms of meaning. And so the best he can do is to, I think, try to create the attempt to understand experience. So it has a lot to do with perception and epistemology, and it's really about understanding rather than about what's there, what's out there. It's about the effort to understand what's out there.
It takes a reader commitment. I guess I just haven't.
Yeah.
I've read some tough books. There's no question.
He's
about
very
that,
difficult.
He is.
I'm working more on the plays, but I'm doing a few of the novels. But it's a very challenging. I did my dissertation on Beckett 100 years ago, and someone flattered me at a convention and said, "Oh, I read your dissertation. Why didn't you ever publish it?" And I was really, this is real vanity. I dug it out of the mothballs, and now I'm really rewriting the whole thing. I mean, I don't feel as I did at the time, but he's a great writer, and he's very addictive. Once I found that he's kind of addictive.
So. American Chronicle, was it your first book?
No, I did a book on, I published a book on, actually I've done a lot of sort of first books on certain people. I did the first American book on Pinter in 1969, and I did the first book on Donald Barthelme in 1981, and I wrote a book on Robert Coover in 1983, and then this came out in 87, and now again in 90. So, and I've done a number of essays and articles on American culture and on a variety of modern writers, poets, and
I was really distressed about Barthelme. I'd never interviewed him, but I bumped into him at, I think, the Penn International Congress meeting here, and we chatted for a while.
Right.
And I said, "Look, when your new book comes out, why don't we talk?" He said, "I'd love to."
Yeah.
And there was a delay in that book, and maybe because he started to become ill, I'm not sure.
I didn't know he was ill myself.
He seemed wonderful when I met him. He was prancing around the auditorium. And
I know.
And I talked to the publisher, and he was going to come to New York, and he canceled. They didn't give me any reason, and then all of a sudden he died.
I know.
And I was just shocked.
I know. The day it was in the Times, I started shaking when I read it, because he was such a vivacious and energetic man. He did smoke a lot. I know that he was a chain smoker. I mean, I recall that about him. And he died of lung cancer. But he had so much energy, and I didn't hear that he was ill. I was given no reason for his cancellations,
but obviously it must have been because he was ill.
Yeah.
Coover amuses me.
Yeah.
I've always enjoyed his stuff. I never. Kind of hard to figure out a little bit, but kind of like Beckett in some. But I enjoy these.
Postmodern.
Postmodernism.
Right.
Yes,
it's a crazy word.
Yeah. I don't even know what that means.
It's a crazy word, because how can you be beyond being modern? You know, but I think the term is used at least for them in order to indicate that they are throwing out the traditional elements of.
What's wrong with experimental?
Well, that's not modern, you know. Faulkner was an experimental writer in the 20s, you know.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. It's probably part of the whole idea to have new concepts. You know, nothing is really absolutely true. Your perception and your expression and experience of something is as true and as correct, valid, let's say, as someone else's. So,
well, these are writers who like to play with the language, with words, and not necessarily meaning.
Yeah,
ignoring plot and character development.
That's exactly
play
right.
Play on language.
Exactly.
Which throws a lot of people off, but I've always admired it. I wish I could do something like that.
I started writing on Barthelme because someone said, why don't you read his work? And I was sitting around the house laughing out loud. Because of his language.
Yeah, it's
and I thought, I don't sit around and laugh out loud, but and then I realized nobody had done anything on him.
I can see where your interests are. Cooper, Beckett, Pinter, too, to a degree, and Barthelme. I can see that those are the kind of writers that that interest you.
Yeah.
They were the bane of writers like John Gardner, though.
Oh, absolutely. He was the bane of these people as well. He wanted to restore literature to the traditional plot and so on. He also had a strange, death. Sudden, wasn't it sudden?
No, motorcycle accident.
Yeah. Yeah.
I remember meeting him once, and he had come down on his motorcycle all the way down from, or was it Binghamton?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And he came into the studio. He came into the studio, and he had a motorcycle uniform, a black leather jacket.
Yeah.
He had his pipe with him. He had a satchel, I guess, he put over his motorcycle. I don't know where he parked it.
Yeah,
but he told me he drove all the way down there, and I was expecting the worst because I was expecting a real academic.
Mm-hmm.
But he was a little tiny
gnome.
Thanks
a lot.
Little gnome, smoking his pipe, and he was very comfortable. And in fact, I remember we startled him. I ran a tape. Who was it I had? I had an E.L. Doctorow, and Doctorow was very critical of Gardner for some reason. I can't remember what the conversation was, but I asked. Doctorow and I were talking just like you and I had taping it just like that. And so I slapped on that tape and played it for Gardner and asked him for his reaction. I think Doctorow called him immature or something.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And Gardner said, I admit it. He said, I was immature. He said, but I grow all the time. And a lot of the things I wrote in the past, for example, in the book Moral Fiction, he said, I would not agree with anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I changed my mind.
Mm-hmm.
Another good story about Gardner. Mm-hmm. When Styron published Sophie's Choice, it was Gardner who wrote the front page review in the New York Times Sunday Book Review.
Mm-hmm.
And it was scathing. It took this book apart.
Oh, really?
Highly critical. Several years later, as Styron told me, somebody asked if Styron would allow a collection of essays about Styron to be published. I think by I can't remember the name of the press. It's up in Boston. So Styron said, yeah, but we'll include both the good and the bad. So he called Gardner and said, is it all right? Do we have your permission to reprint your critical review of my book in this collection of essays? And Gardner says, absolutely, you can do it, with one exception. I want to write a preface to it, repudiating the review because I've changed my mind and I think Sophie's Choice is now a masterpiece.
Isn't that something?
So, I mean, like everybody,
I guess
he grew.
Sure.
Well, we digressed from the American Chronicle, and our time is really up. But this is, Lois, this is just a terrific book. And
thanks
it's a book
so
that
much,
I
Don.
Use all the time.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
I just hope that you stay with it and don't, in 10 years from now, another decade will have passed, and you bring us up to 1999. That's kind of scary, isn't it?
Yeah, isn't it?
We cover a whole bunch of ground here. It's terrific.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.